From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Left, Right, and Center presents 1 year later.
1 year later.
Can you believe it's 1 year later?
1 year later.
1 year later.
This land is your land.
Hi, I'm Jamil Smith, one of your hosts for the special series 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. It's the Trump era, and we're taking a new approach to political debate. Today, race and sports have always been intertwined in America, but in the Trump era, they're inseparable in a new way. The president has seen fit to insert himself into many debates, castigating everyone from athletes protesting racial injustice to critics in the press. Lately, he's been lashing out at infamous sports dad LeVar Ball. Other personalities have knocked Trump, but he only seems to target the black ones. Can the sports world ever properly deal with its racial issues with Trump as president? That's coming up on 1 year later, after headlines from NPR.
Check out KCRW's All News Channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Your land. We're back with 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Jamil Smith, contributing opinion writer with the Los Angeles Times. First, our top story of the day. President Trump got up early this morning to criticize LeVar Ball, the father of LiAngelo Ball, one of the three UCLA basketball players who had been arrested in China for shoplifting recently. Trump claims that he alone secured their release and return to the United States, but the elder Ball refused to thank Trump. He told ESPN on Friday, quote, "What was he over there for?" meaning the president. "Don't tell me nothing. Everybody wants to make it seem like he helped me out," unquote. Trump tweeted on November 19th that he should have left the players in jail. They were never actually in jail, but still. And lashed out again this morning with tweets about LeVar Ball, calling him, quote, "an ungrateful fool." Joining us now by phone is Dave Zirin, the sports editor for The Nation magazine and the host of the Edge of Sports podcast. Dave, welcome to 1 year later.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, Dave, you wrote in The Nation that in a sane world, we wouldn't be talking about Donald Trump versus LeVar Ball. Are we the real losers in this fight?
In so many respects, we are the real losers, because what we're subjected to is a president who openly uses racism as a way to demonize, distract, and divide us as a people. And that makes us a loser. It doesn't mean that LeVar Ball is a loser by any stretch. I mean, if anything, LeVar Ball is a big winner in this, in that his platform, his brand has skyrocketed. And Donald Trump, to some degree, is a winner, too, in that people in the media, like myself, you know, are talking about this story and are forced to talk about this story, as opposed to the fact that the president has just endorsed and defended a senatorial candidate who's been credibly accused of pedophilia.
Oh, I haven't heard anything about that. What are you talking about?
Yeah, little things like that are in the news right now that then don't get the attention that it absolutely deserves. So I think that there's a method to Trump's madness in attacking LeVar Ball, but it's an ugly method. Mm-hmm. And I would also argue it's an extremely tired method, because one thing that needs to be pointed out is that this practice of going after people who are from the black community, who are connected to the world of sports, and who have a platform as a grievance issue to build support among racist white people. I mean, that is something that has been in the playbook of U.S. politics, frankly, as long as black people have been involved in sports in this country.
Now, Bill Plachke of the Los Angeles Times criticized Ball in a blistering column this morning, mostly for not thanking the president, among other offenses. Are there actual grounds to criticize Ball here?
No, there are not grounds to criticize LeVar Ball. I mean, I can't believe how incredibly callous we've become to the idea of lying in this country, and this idea of truth being something that, well, it just matters whether if you check an R or a D by your name. But what Donald Trump has been tweeting, like this idea that LeVar Ball's son, LiAngelo, was facing 10 years in a Chinese jail, that's not true. The idea that he was in prison, that's not true. He was in his hotel, for goodness sakes. The idea that people weren't already doing all kinds of work. All this has been widely reported in the sports page. Yet Trump could still create this fiction as if LiAngelo Ball and his two teammates were somehow in a Chinese jail cell and Donald Trump came to the rescue to get him out. That's just not what happened. And also, I have to say, like, the idea of somebody not just asking for thanks, but demanding thanks from you in this context, especially when this particular president has such a history of, let's call it an oppositional history towards people who look like LeVar Ball and were from the sports community, particularly the basketball community of LeVar Ball. I'm not sure why he owes Donald Trump thanks for anything at this point, particularly when it was asked for in such a boorish and, frankly, unpresidential way. Mm-hmm. Now, take it another step as well with all of this, like in terms of Bill Plaschke's column. I mean, he also criticizes LeVar Ball in this for, like, exploiting his own kids and whatnot. And that's one of the things. Selective outrage, I have to say, is one of my least favorite things in the world, because unless Bill Plaschke is writing every day about people throughout the wide world of sports who prey on young athletes, I mean, to focus on LeVar Ball as if he is somehow the symbol of a multi-billion-dollar sports industry that preys on the hopes, dreams, aspirations, and fears of young athletes, to me is just an absolutely absurd example of selective outrage for the purposes of a political agenda.
Now, of course, you also note in your column that we're only talking about all of this because Trump is president. And how has that fact, do you feel, Dave, changed how we talk about sports and race in general?
Well, yeah, I mean, first of all, the fact that Donald Trump is president means, Jamil, that we have to have this conversation that we're having right now, that I had to write that article for The Nation, even though the world does not exist where I would have taken the time to write about two people I would classify as reality TV blowhards yelling at each other. Mm. You know, I mean, in a sane world, this should be like Rob Kardashian versus Blac Chyna, and we're sort of like smirking at it back and forth as we go about our day. But unfortunately, when you have someone who's the president say, gee, I should have left those people in a Chinese prison because their father wasn't grateful enough to me, or uses racism as a way to demonize people for the purposes of appealing to the lizard brain of his base, then unfortunately it becomes all of our problem. And that's the worst part about this. Look,
right.
Donald Trump, I'm from New York City. Donald Trump's been in my life for over three decades at this point.
Yikes.
The first political T-shirt I ever got in my life was an anti-Trump shirt when I was 8 years old when he was trying to bulldoze Central Park.
Ooh. Dave, I got to actually leave it right there because we're running out of time. But I want to thank you again, Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation. Coming up on 1 year Later, we continue this conversation about race and sports in the age of Trump. That's next on 1 year Later from Public Radio International. We're back with 1 year Later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Jamil Smith, contributing opinion writer at the Los Angeles Times. From criticizing NFL players for taking a knee during the anthem, to demanding that UCLA basketball players thank him sufficiently for their release from Chinese custody, President Trump has been quite vocal about black sports figures. And while there are a few prominent white personalities who have criticized the president, Eminem, what have you, Trump seems most comfortable lashing out against sports figures of color. What do you think are the roots of this dynamic, and is it making the dialogue around racial inequality better or worse? To talk about this, we are joined by Todd Boyd, Catherine and Frank Price Endowed Chair for the Study of Race and Popular Culture and Professor of Critical Studies at the USC School of Cinematic Art, Amira Rose Davis, Professor of History and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at Penn State University, and Brian Curtis, Editor-at-Large of The Ringer, a sports and pop culture website. Welcome, all of you, to 1 year Later.
Hi.
Thank you.
So I want to start by reminding our audience what President Donald Trump said about the NFL in September. In an odd setting, it was during a rally for Senate candidate Luther Strange in Alabama.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a bitch off the field right now, out, he's fired.
Professor Boyd, I want to talk about the idea of gratitude. This consistent thread through President Trump's criticism of athletes is rooted in the idea that these athletes are not thankful enough for all that they've gotten. They're rich, they're prominent, they're famous, and somehow they're not grateful enough for all the gifts they've been given. The UCLA athletes aren't thankful, in this case, for being released from Chinese custody. How do you read that criticism?
Well, I think, there's been a long tradition
a history even of this image of African Americans who are successful not being grateful for their success. And so, you know, when you talk about the visibility of prominent black athletes, individuals who are some of the most visible African Americans in society, you know, individuals whose salaries are generally well known by the public, you find an easy target for someone who's attempting to gain points with his base by making some very overt racial attacks. So in that way, to go after successful black athletes, you appeal to a mindset which says that these individuals have been, you know, given certain benefits as opposed to earning them, and that they are ungrateful for all the good fortune they've been able to experience. And so it's basically a way to say that these wealthy, successful black athletes are not grateful enough to the dominant white society that made this possible for them.
Professor Davis, I wanted you to weigh in on this. It's a longstanding version of a dynamic, I believe, that persists in American culture. This, you know, the powerful white figure criticizing the black athletes or the black people who are rich for not being grateful to all for all the things that they've been given by this country. What do you think about this specific criticism coming from the president?
Yeah, precisely. I concur with Dr. Boyd. There's such a long history here. And with Trump, you don't even have to look very far to see that high profile and, you know, African-Americans have drawn his ear. This is the same as Jemele Hill. This is, you know, April Ryan in a different kind of field as well. And I think that there's a particular way that it gets coded where it's just like these uppity Negroes need to be put back in their place. And if you think back to, say, like Jack Johnson, the thing that pissed people off about Jack Johnson beyond his just ability and the fact that nobody could beat him was that he was rocking furs and he dated white women and he was driving cars. And so there's this idea that, you know, if you're not grateful, then you're taking advantage of the position that we have given you. We are always positioning ourselves as like the benevolent white savior. We are allowing you to have a piece of the American pie. And I think that is, you know, precisely why these targets are highly visible. Sports has been often thought as a place where it's like kind of integrationist arena, but in really a lot of ways, it's also a laboratory. It's a place where you can discipline black bodies because it is a site of some of the most visible black bodies.
Speaking of visible targets, it's not just Jack Johnson, the famous boxer from a long time ago, but also Jemele Hill, the ESPN anchor, as you mentioned, who tweeted a while back that Trump is a white supremacist. Now, she caught hell for that. And while she is a friend of mine, I must disclose, Brian, I know that you've written about her at length. Can you remind folks what happened there?
Yeah, you know, she was engaged in a Twitter dialogue, as she often is. Those were not words that were said on ESPN. It was Jemele's own Twitter account. And she said that Trump was a white supremacist. And, you know, a couple of days passed, and then everybody kind of lost their minds, as they often do in this 2017 world we live in. You know, first, Sarah Huckabee Sanders said from the White House podium that she should be fired. Private citizen, a sportscaster in this case, should be fired. And then Trump followed up himself on Twitter. And then Jemele Hill came back a couple weeks later, weighed in on the – she wasn't disciplined by ESPN, by the way, for that. And then a couple weeks later, she came in and talked about, you know, the idea of a boycott of the NFL – which had been suggested because of Jerry Jones, the Cowboys owner's comments about kneeling football players, and for that she was suspended.
Now, what did you argue in your piece?
Well, what I argued essentially is that, you know, there's this, we have this problem right now in 2017 in the sports media. And I'd say to Professor Boyd's critique, what the only thing I'd add about ungrateful black athletes, that's something that's persisted in the sports pages for a really, really long time, right? This is not just, you know, politicians or certain people. I mean, this is some, you know, a pose adopted by lots of sports writers throughout history. And I think the problem you see now, you know, in the sports press is, are we going to allow people to talk about the way they feel? If you feel that the nation is in crisis right now, if you feel that, you know, the president of the United States is, as Jemele put it, is a white supremacist, should you be able to say that? Or do you have to work within the confines of this kind of old idea where sports writing and politics don't mix and they exist on their separate planes?
Now, one of
talk to Professor Boyd again about this, the NFL conflict specifically. The NFL commissioner, Roger Goodell, has said that he's, you know, players should stand during the national anthem. He's kind of gone back and forth a little bit with that. There's been some reports that he's supported the players privately, but certainly publicly he's made remarks like this at a press conference in October when he was speaking about how he's working with sponsors over the issue.
All of this is part of the ongoing effort and understanding one another and making sure that we do the right thing in our communities and the right thing to support our players, but also do the right thing to make sure we get back to football. And in the meantime, people understand how important our country is and how important it is to make sure that we're doing things the right way to honor our country.
Dr. Boyd, is he favoring sponsors over the players? And has that polarized the issue more?
Well, Roger Goodell has had a rather rocky tenure in one sense. And in other ways, he's been especially effective as NFL commissioner. His salary is especially high. Mm. But throughout the time he's been, you know, the commissioner, there's been questions about his dealings with players in terms of discipline and other such issues, even before, you know, this political issue developed around Trump. You know, Roger Goodell has a league to run, and I imagine he, you know, prioritizes that over everything, certainly black players choosing to protest. But he recognizes that, you know, simply saying they can't do it presents another problem, because clearly there's a number of players who've decided to do it regardless. And so I think, you know, from his perspective, he wants this to go away and wants to appear to be paying attention to all sides, the owners who pay him, the sponsors who support the league, and the players who, you know, make the league, who play in the league, who are the reason that people, you know, watch football games in the first place. So he's trying to, I think, you know, appease as many constituencies as possible. But it should be clearly understood that Roger Goodell's priority is running the NFL. And as I say, he's paid by the owners. And so this should speak to his ultimate motivation in spite of you know, what statements might be made publicly.
Brian Curtis, what have you been hearing from players or other people affiliated with the league about how the commissioner has behaved in the wake of the president's criticism?
I don't think I don't think players in the NFL trust the commissioner at all. I think they see him, if anything, as on the side of the opposition, as they see with almost every single owner in the NFL. We could probably name some notable exceptions, but I think, you know, the commissioner probably looks slightly more reasonable on this issue because he has people now like Jerry Jones who are so far onto the other side of the issue, who came out and said if anybody kneels, they're going to go to the bench, right? Which is pretty close to Donald Trump's critique that you just played the clip of. So no, I don't think they trust Roger Goodell at all. I think the amazing thing about this, by the way, is that we have created this space within the NFL for political speech.
Mm.
I'm not sure that existed in the same way a year ago and 2 years ago. You know, it's an outrage and that Colin Kaepernick doesn't have a job, but I think the movement that he started really has made the NFL into this place where you can speak out publicly about these issues, and I think that's just amazing given the history of that league and the history of the players' union and everything else.
Dr. Davis, I want to ask you about Colin Kaepernick specifically. Of course, he's the former 49ers quarterback who began these protests by kneeling during the preseason in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he really hasn't talked to the media that much. Do you think his silence has been effective?
Oh, tremendously. Because, one, it's almost like making people commit unforced errors. His silence has allowed, you know, the responses of everybody else to actually amplify and strengthen his point. Everybody else is projecting onto him in ways that actually highlights exactly what some of the issues he's talking about. Beyond that, and you can see this with the recent kind of GQ magazine, is I think it appropriately places him in a symbolic role. And really, that's essentially what he has helped cultivate with the movement. I mean, he wasn't the first to kneel or kind of protest this. We know that WNBA players, of course, we're like doing this in July before we the media word, a world awoken to what he was doing, but he very much has become the symbol. And I think one of the things with symbols is if they're silent, you can do more with them. They're more malleable. And the GQ issue was so effective because it allowed all these other people to offer wonderful supports and critiques and kind of a platform for him that's only amplifying his message.
Mm-hmm. Yes, of course, you're speaking about the cover of GQ magazine in which he was named as Citizen of the Year. Mm-hmm. I want to then pivot, though, to what you were talking about with female athletes. Now, we've been talking a lot about male athletes up until now. Female athletes are unfortunately less visible. How are they protesting racial inequality?
Yeah, so, I mean, women athletes, particularly in the WNBA, have been fairly active. When Philandro Castile and Alton Sterling were killed in July of 2016, members of the Minnesota Lynx held a pre-game press conference. They all should don black shirts. And this was a tradition that had stretched back to when they wore I Can't Breathe shirts, along with people like the Notre Dame basketball team. And so I think, but exactly what you pointed to, it's less of a platform. One of the things that happened as these women in the WNBA who both kneeled for the anthem and wore these shirts is the WNBA actually tried to fine them for violating dress code because they were wearing plain black shirts in for Black Lives Matter.
And, interesting.
They tried, yeah.
Interesting.
And the thing with the fine is that they tried. Yeah, go ahead.
No. Women have, you know, I would say a lot more to lose, you know, because they're not making the same kinds of salaries that the, say, Precisely. NBA players are making. They don't have the same visibility. How have they been so effective then in this arena with activism throughout the years?
Right. I mean, I think that part of it, it's a double-edged sword, right? So part of having less of a platform is you have less to risk. So a lot of these women who are protesting aren't risking, say, the multi-million dollar contracts and sponsorships that we see some male athletes standing to lose and actually losing because of they're being outspoken. But then you have somebody like Serena who's able to effectively use the tools, so Players Tribune, social media, where they can cut out the middleman and have their own voice. I think the biggest danger with female athletes is that, and this is historical as well, is that their kind of disciplining of them is to just ignore their voices, is to take away their platform. And I think that this moment is particularly great because of Twitter, because of the Players Tribune, because they can actually, they don't have to wait for anybody to give them a mic for them to talk about these issues. And so you're seeing them kind of sustain this engagement through things like blog posts or the WNBA players who said, we're not going to take any post-game comments unless it has to do with police brutality. And that is a way that they've effectively given themselves a platform that wasn't necessarily there prior.
Indeed, indeed. Very quickly, Dr. Boyd, we just have about a minute left before our break. Wanted to ask you about white athletes. How have you seen them step up, and do you feel like they need to be doing more?
Well, I think it's up to the individual whether they want to do more or do less. It's not my place to tell someone what they should or shouldn't do, but you know, there have been some NFL players who are white who've spoken up, you know, about Kaepernick's ability. Others have spoken up in support of some of their teammates. But, you know, this started with Kaepernick protesting against police brutality against African Americans. So I think, you know, when you look at it that way, it speaks to, you know, certain ideas. But you've also had people like Greg Popovich and Steve Kerr in the NBA speak out in support of this as well. So it's sort of interesting to see a variety of responses in support in both the NFL and the NBA.
All right, we're going to leave it there for a minute. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll have more of this conversation. This is 1 year later from PRI. Again, I'm Jamil Smith, and this is 1 year Later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. Today, we're talking about race and sports with Dr. Todd Boyd of USC, Dr. Amira Rose Davis of Penn State, and Brian Curtis of The Ringer. So I wanted to go back to this conversation. We're talking mainly about the NFL and the protest of, you know, that Colin Kaepernick began in 2016. President Trump also tweeted this morning about his other favorite target, the NFL, when he wasn't dealing with LeVar Ball. 280 characters are too long for me to read out on the radio, but he complained about a supposed new idea, keeping teams in the locker room next season during the anthem. Brian, do you know what he's talking about?
Yeah, I mean, the one sort of, you know, kind of third way, if that's the word for it, that has been suggested is that you just keep teams in the locker room, you go ahead and play the anthem in the stadium. And that way, no, you never see if anybody kneels or not, which was actually a strategy the Steelers used this year, right? They all stayed in the locker room, and that was kind of a way of being united, quote-unquote, because nobody was going to kneel for the anthem. You didn't know what the players were doing during the anthem. I guess Trump considers this to be a cop-out and that they should play it. I mean, I find the whole – I'm a huge sports fan. I go to lots and lots of games, and I just find the whole – idea that we have to have a national anthem before every sporting event in America, from the biggest pro leagues down to, you know, high school stuff, to be very, very strange. And it seems like if there's anything they want to do, it's just eliminate the national anthem from the sporting event altogether. That sure would solve a lot of things.
Dr. Boyd, what's your take on that? Do you think that there's been a politicization of the games well before people started kneeling? I mean, there's been national anthems played before the games. There's a lot of pageantry, military planes flying overhead. What do you think about that?
Well, a couple things. First of all, we should point out that it's not always been the case that NFL players were on the field during the playing of the national anthem. But a few years ago, the Defense Department contracted with the NFL as a, marketing and recruiting effort to have the players on the field, standing to pledge allegiance during the national anthem as a way to recruit people into the military. So part of this has to do more with marketing, I think, than patriotism, and that's a issue that people seem to be confusing. I should also point out that historically, if you were to go back to the 1960s, for instance, the early 1970s, I remember an incident back in Detroit, where I'm from, in the late 1960s, when the Tigers were in the World Series, and Jose Feliciano, the Latino folk singer, sang the national anthem, and he sang it in his own way, in his own style, and people were outraged over his interpretation of the anthem, saying that it was unpatriotic and un-American. This was a Latino singer singing a song in his own style as opposed to singing it the way it had traditionally been sung. So, when you talk about these things, the singing of the national anthem, the Pledge of Allegiance, these are political acts that have been included as part of the presentation of sports. It's not organic. It's been added to create an overall picture. And I think when you look at that and you look closely at what's going on, this is an issue that's been around in some shape or form for a very long time. And it's often one of the first places people go when they want to criticize athletes by saying they're not patriotic enough, which takes us back to that point ultimately about not being considered grateful enough.
Dr. Davis, I want to ask you about sports just in general. They're about so much more than entertainment. Why are they such fertile ground for expressing larger, concerns about racial tensions in the country?
Yeah, I think it's because it gives you the guise of meritocracy. And again, historically speaking, right, you have Jack Johnson in the ring, and it's hard to say that African-Americans are inferior if he's knocking people out, right? And if I line up next to you on the 100-yard line and beat you, that goes a lot to showing that, hey, I can have, equal rights and full citizenship rights, especially in international sporting competitions. This kind of gets flexed on. So you have Jesse Owens, you have the women I write about, Wilma Rudolph and them, who court international goodwill. And it's a site where you can have these kind of visible declarations of both unity, or you can use it to kind of black press. Black sports writers have long used sports as a way to push, as an arm of pushing for full citizenship rights in this country. And I think it's a very effective vessel. Plus, our country is just obsessed with them. So it is one of the things that falls into the limelight over and over and over again.
Now, Brian, I want to ask you about the media specifically. I mean, Trump's tweets about the NFL and its players, they're broadcast everywhere. Considering that, what Dr. Davis was just talking about, that, sports can be helpful in the conversation about race and racism. How can the media be hurtful?
How can the media's coverage of this be hurtful?
Yes. And is it being hurtful, do you feel like?
You know, I'm sure we could find plenty of examples of, you know, the kind of just Trump tweets as pure thoughtless, brainless content being used that we saw, you know, frankly, throughout the political media over the last election, right? Mm. Where Trump tweets something and you just treat it as a goofy controversy rather than trying to dig below and find out what's really there. But, you know, I think if anything, it's just really kicked off a lot of discussion about race and important issues within the sports media. And we're not going to pat anybody on the back here, but I think if you look, you just find lots and lots of conversations. You find interviews with players like Malcolm Jenkins. You find the GQ story about Colin Kaepernick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, really when Trump comes into this thing, after the one thing that I think people forget is that the protests were, to some extent, petering out just a little bit, right? There are fewer players doing it. The idea that it was really about police violence was getting lost with all this talk about the flag and patriotism and stuff. And then Trump comes in as the enemy. And he really accidentally, or not accidentally, galvanized, I think, these protests in a lot of ways. And I think to the extent he's brought media attention to it, I would say probably on balance, a lot of it is really, really good and thoughtful and interesting and gets sports fans who might not think about this stuff or might not want to think about this stuff a little more focused on it.
Dr. Boyd, in the 60s, sports were, of course, incredibly political. And in the last few decades, it seems like maybe less so. Is Trump's presidency, and to speak to Brian's point, in some strange way helpful for furthering racial dialogue?
Furthering racial dialogue? I would say no. Look, you know, Trump has a style. People still seem to not realize what they're dealing with. It's pretty transparent to me. Trump's style, he needs enemies. You know, he needs, you know, the lamestream media or, you know, whoever it is, little Marco. I mean, he needs enemies. This is part of the show he puts on.
Right.
And, you know, black athletes are easy targets in this way. So I think a lot of this is calculated because, as we've, you know, previously discussed, I mean, there's been a lot of resentment towards black athletes for a long time. And so Trump recognizes that and, you know, it appeals to the people who support him. And so, you know, he can go and get the applause he requires by criticizing black athletes when at the same time, you know, his campaign is being investigated for collusions with a foreign government, his inability to get anything accomplished in terms of a legislative agenda. I mean, you know, it's a lot easier to sort of, you know, go after prominent black athletes and get the applause from the Trump supporters than it is to deal with the reality that nothing's been accomplished since he's been in office, and it looks like a lot of darkness on the horizon. So I think this is calculated and part of a long-time strategy he's used of picking people to be his enemies so that he can conduct this show that has vaulted him to the highest office in the land.
Dr. Amir Rose Davis, I wanted to go further on that point. Van Newkirk wrote in The Atlantic today about this specific thing. And you know, it's anyone's guess whether or not this is going to continue to work for the president, he writes. But, you know, notes that his sinking approval ratings, even among white voters, may indicate that the well is indeed running dry. Can you speculate as to whether or not this has a long shelf life as a strategy for him?
Well, I'm a little bit pessimistic. I think that there is a core of his base where this will continue to work for, because he becomes the vessel where they can have not only their kind of anger and fear stoked, but told that they're legitimate grievances and told that it's okay to be, you know, this angry at people. And I think that will hold true. I think you might start seeing it wear off as things happen, like he tanks the economy. I think you know, you might start see it wear off in a little bit here and there as he just kind of reopened and reinvited criticism with him around sexual assault. But again, this has been, what, 2 years now where he's been in this platform doing this same exact game. And a great deal of people in this country elected him to the highest office. So I'm not very optimistic that it will work, but I think that it will ever end, rather. But I think that more and more people are addressing and pointing out that he seems to get on Twitter and unleash a tweet storm on a person and make an enemy, particularly, as Dr. Boyd said, when something for him is not looking good in another area.
Dr. Davis, I want to follow up with that. You know, how much about this do you feel is about, say, toxic masculinity and not just race?
Oh, well, I think they're intertwined. And I think that sometimes it can be very hard to, you know, separate them. And they shouldn't necessarily be separated, because it's not that he's a man, it's that he's a white man, right? And I think that that kind of projection of might and feeling of kind of power is completely wedded with this toxic masculinity we have in this country. You can see with his pressers around, you know, Moore's campaign in Alabama. You can see in his own deflection or his own kind of brushing off his All Access tape about locker room talk, right? This is just how men talk. This is nothing. This is fine. This is how heterosexual, manly men behave. And I think that that also is a key component, because for the people who find liking in him and want to support him, he's offering a kind of return to this white patriarchy that they felt has been slipping away.
I want to get everyone's opinion on this next question. I feel like Trump only goes after black sports figures for the reasons that you've discussed, but there are some that he leaves out, and one of them is LeBron James. LeBron James, the superstar Cleveland Cavaliers forward, has, you know, spoken up quite a bit about the president, and also recently about Colin Kaepernick, saying that he definitely believes that Kaepernick is being blackballed by the NFL. Now, do you feel like there's a reason, Dr. Boyd, that the president hasn't gone after LeBron James?
Yes, there's a reason. LeBron James is more popular than Donald Trump. It's that simple. I think it's important, you know, to recognize that this new era of black athlete activism, if that's what you want to call it, really for me begins with that photo that LeBron and his teammates Dwayne Wade and others took when he was still playing for the Heat in Miami a few years ago around the a murder of Trayvon Martin, the photo with them all wearing their hoodies. And interestingly enough, what we've seen come about since then, some of this has been mentioned, I Can't Breathe, you know, Ferguson, Missouri. Like, it kind of all goes back to that moment, which was a sort of break from what had been the sort of previous way athletes conducted themselves under the ethos of Michael Jordan's famous Republicans Buy Nikes Too. It's as though that era had passed and LeBron kind of initiates a new era. But I think, you know, this is what I'm saying. Trump is very selective in who he picks out to go after. And LeBron is someone who, of course, was very strongly supporting Hillary Clinton near the end of the presidential campaign. He's someone who has an immense amount of popularity in this country and across the globe. And so I think, you know, the pattern we see is Trump tries to pick on people who he thinks are weak. LeBron, in this sense, is not weak. And so in the same way that Trump has avoided going after Greg Popovich, who Popovich is almost taunting him and he won't say anything. You know, it's a sort of classic example of a bully. You know, he knows who he can pick on and get away with. And then there are other people he will avoid at all costs, because in that instance, he would be exposed. And so I think that's really the case of what's going on here, and the silence towards someone like LeBron or even someone like Greg Popovich.
Yeah. The idea of Trump as bully is certainly it's not something that's limited to sports, certainly, but I think it's certainly applicable here. Brian, I want to go to a quick last word on this. It can be a little bit depressing to think that this conversation isn't, you know, is being either held back or regressed by the president. What do you think there are some things that point to progress?
I'd say a couple of things. By the way, on the whole point of Trump attacking people less popular than himself, he also attacks Steph Curry, by the way, for being ungrateful for his invitation to the
Indeed.
White House. I'm sure it may just be that he hasn't gotten around to LeBron James yet. We don't know quite how his mind works. I'd say in terms of progress, here's one thing I could point to. In October, the USA Today did a poll, and 51% of the people surveyed thought the players' protests were appropriate, and 68% thought that Trump's call for them to be benched or fined was inappropriate for kneeling during the national anthem. And I'd say that, you know, what you are seeing in a way is perhaps, you know, Trump kind of blundering into these things. While I would certainly not dispute that he is playing to an audience, and he's going to, I don't know what his electoral prospects are going to look like in 3 years. I do think that the country is thinking about these things, and it probably hasn't thought about these things enough. And I hope that in those poll numbers you can see a little bit of a silver lining and say that, well, maybe people are rethinking this and these kinds of issues and the whole idea of race in sports.
All right. Well, we have to leave it there. Thank you to all of my guests, Dr. Todd Boyd, Catherine and Frank Price Endowed Chair for the Study of Race and Popular Culture and Professor of Critical Studies at the USC School of Cinematic Art, Dr. Amira Rose Davis, Assistant Professor of History and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at Penn State University, and Brian Curtis, Editor-at-Large of The Ringer. Thank you all very much. When we come back, our Talk It Out segment with a look at an ever-widening sexual harassment scandal on Capitol Hill. That's when we continue with 1 year later from PRI. I'm Jamil Smith, back with 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. This is the part of the show where we talk it out, where we talk through the big political stories of the day with two political viewpoints. Since I'm representing the left, we're bringing in Evan Siegfried. He's a Republican strategist and our voice from the right today. Hello, Evan.
Hi, Jamil. How are you?
All right. Welcome to 1 year later. The editorial page of the Detroit Free Press today called for Representative John Conyers to resign after allegations of sexual harassment have come to light. Democratic leaders are promising to investigate, but his colleague, Jim Clyburn, suggested that the allegations could have been made up. Evan, what say you about this?
Hey, I'm very disappointed with Jim Clyburn's comments, to be honest with you. I don't see allegations of sexual harassment and sexual misconduct as a partisan issue. I see it as a moral issue. And be it Roy Moore, Al Franken, John Conyers, I think they all don't deserve to be representing people in elected office. And to see that Democrats are saying, well, we're just going to do an ethics investigation and really run through that, it's really window dressing for a much bigger problem. They need to make it very clear that this type of behavior is not tolerated among our leaders.
So in that respect, should we be calling for the resignations of, say, people like Senator Al Franken, Congressman Conyers? Is that really the point in which they should start the conversation?
I think at this point, yes, because we are seeing, with what has been coming out since the Harvey Weinstein revelations, women stand up and be brave and say, I am a victim, and this is the person who did it. And we're seeing more and more people speak out, and I think that's a very positive thing in a way to in dealing with a very big problem that needs to be eradicated. And I really believe that there are people who are defending Roy Moore, as well as Al Franken and to a certain extent John Conyers, who are actually poisoning the well. Michelle Goldberg had a piece in the New York Times, I believe, yesterday where she said, what Al Franken is accused of is horrible, but he shouldn't resign because he shares my morals. And that's the same argument that Roy Moore's accusers supporters are making as to why Doug Jones shouldn't be in the U.S. Senate. And I think that's absolutely wrong, and it's perverting it. And at the same time, Bette Midler today tweeted out a picture of Leanne Tweeden from her Playboy cover and implied that she was asking for it because of her past.
Oh, boy.
And I think that's very sick. And it's, again, you know me, and I try and stand up for every moral value I believe in. And this, to me, is something that is beyond the pale of, and it's not a political thing. It's a moral one, and what example we want to set to our children.
Yes. On this, I think we have to agree. We're supposed to be disagreeing, Evan. Come on. I think that what needs to be done is, I think Al Franken should resign, and I think that Congressman Conyers, these allegations are reading are true, he definitely should be resigning. And so, actually, I didn't want to qualify it with the if true thing, because I think that's a lot of what Republicans have done with Roy Moore. But I want to get to one of the weirdest parts of this Conyers story, Evan. It's that Mike Cernovich, the Pizzagate guy, was one of the sources of the story for BuzzFeed. And he's the men's rights activist, Trump supporter, public professional liar.
Conspiracy theorist as well, which is he helped propagate Pizzagate.
Right.
I've never been a fan of Mike Cernovich. I believe that most of what he stands for is absolutely wrong and immoral. But I have to give him credit where credit is due here. He was smart enough to recognize that he could have taken what he had on Congressman Conyers and published it through InfoWars, and how much traction would it really have gotten had that happened? Very little. He recognized that a place like BuzzFeed publishing it would actually have a real impact where people would turn their head and listen. Steve Bannon did the same thing in 2016 with the book Clinton Cash, where he gave exclusives about Hillary Clinton and things she was doing that were suspicious to the New York Times, and the New York Times published it. Had Bannon published it on Breitbart, it would have just been lost in the conservative echo chamber. So I have to give Mike Cernovich a certain amount of credit for what he did by giving this to BuzzFeed and recognizing that the best way to deal with this problem was to give it to a place that would have much more legitimacy than his own outlets.
Well, see, this part of the story really troubles me, I got to say, because I have to agree with my former colleague, Brian Beutler, who's now the editor-chief of Crooked.com. He wrote this, you know, this morning about this, essentially saying that it's all right to be pleased that this is coming out and alarmed that someone like Mike Cernovich is releasing it. But to me, this is what this is what Breitbart is talking about when they talk about weaponizing information. And it's not necessarily something that you can't just trust these guys when you feel like trusting them, right?
No, you shouldn't at the same time think that Mike Cernovich is all of a sudden a completely trustworthy person, because remember, his history is one that he should not be regarded as such. But on this particular issue, he absolutely was. He had the documentation. It was somebody else gave it to him who trusted him. Now, I think that we have to go and actually look at what is going on and what these stories are and the content. And BuzzFeed put it through a very thorough review process and used journalistic integrity to back up the claims. It wasn't, hey, I have this thing, and then BuzzFeed hit publish. Mm-hmm. They went through a very thorough review, and with Ben Smith at the helm, you can rest assured they absolutely would.
Yes, and Shawnee Hilton as well. Yeah. Yes, I want to pivot now to the other, I guess you could say, prominent case of sexual harassment and assault that's in the news, which is Roy Moore, the Republican candidate for U.S. Senate in Alabama. Now, Tim Miller, the former Jeb Bush campaign advisor, took to Twitter yesterday to announce that he donated money to Doug Jones, Moore's Democratic opponent. What do you make of that, Evan? Will he inspire other Republicans to help Doug Jones win?
I think you've got to look at it in a different frame of light. Mm-hmm. What you have going on in the Republican Party right now is, I think there's a generational divide. Younger Republicans do not believe in the values of the older Republican Party. We believe much more in matters of equality and justice, et cetera. And Tim Miller, he and I are roughly the same age, and we grew up in the age of hearing about how we are the great moral majority and the Family Values Party. I wrote in the New York Daily News early last week that we were sold a bill of goods. The Bill Bennett's of the world lied to us, because now they're defending Roy Moore. And they told us that we were the party of family values. Remember, in 1995, we were about to expel Senator Bob Packwood, a Republican, from the Senate for sexual harassment. And just before we were going to vote on his expulsion, he resigned just to keep a modicum of dignity. And then 3 years later, Bob Livingston was supposed to succeed Newt Gingrich as Speaker of the House, and it came out that he'd had a consensual affair with a woman who was above the age of 18, and he was drummed out of Congress. That was the moral values we stood for. And now that's gone by the wayside. It's Roy Moore preyed on 14-year-old girls. You have this pastor saying, well, you know, they were pure as a result of their youth, and the people who are defending it. And then there are also people saying, well, it's better than having a liberal Democrat in the Senate who could vote against Republican values. And when President Trump said that yesterday, I said, well, yes, it is bad to have a liberal Democrat take that Senate seat, but it's worse to have a man who is accused of child molestation and preying on young teenage girls who weren't even of age to consent to any sort of sexual relations with anyone.
Right.
So I'm willing to eat crow and have a Democrat in that Senate seat, and I'm much more comfortable with that than having somebody like Roy Moore in that seat.
I mean, speaking of the contradictions involved here, you're talking about having the president go on camera yesterday and say that Doug Jones, who prosecuted the Ku Klux Klan members that bombed the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham in 1963, killing four little black girls. He successfully prosecuted those guys, and yet he's being called by this president soft on crime. It just seems that, you know, they have the same vocabulary to just, you know, spit out whenever they want to, and it doesn't necessarily have to have any ideological consistency.
No, I don't think the president even knows Doug Jones's name, to be honest with you, and I think he just says that. Whenever it's a Democrat, it's this boilerplate language of they're soft on crime, they don't like borders, they don't want to work with us. he couldn't name a single thing that Democrats are proposing or anything that they value or any sort of intricacies of Democrats. And I think that it's just absolutely silly, and the president is coming off more and more ridiculous. If you look at the polls right now, you see more and more people do not believe Donald Trump and what he says. And it goes back to the generational divide within the Republican Party. Younger Republicans are sick and tired of what has been going on within this party, especially with regard to Trump. Between December 2015 and March 2017, Republicans aged 18 to 29, the number of them that left the party were 23%. So we are a party that is contracting and shrinking. Bear in mind that the younger you are, the more likely you are to be a minority or mixed race, and you're the most diverse generation in America. And as I've said before, Republicans who are younger do believe in equality and tolerance of others who are different. So when you see that this party that is pushing away and saying you should blame the others for everything that's going on, we're not having it. We're not buying it.
Thank you, Evan Siegfried. He's a Republican strategist and the author of the book GOP GPS, How to Find the Millennials and Urban Voters the Republican Party Needs to Survive. Thank you, Evan.
Thank you, Jamil.
That's all for us today on One Year Later. Meet us back here tomorrow for our show on race and guns. On Monday, Jennifer Rubin, the conservative opinion writer at The Washington Post, takes over hosting duties for 2 weeks. Tune in for a totally different take on political debate. I had a great time hosting, and I'm thankful to Quinn O'Toole, Katie Cooper, and the entire KCRW crew for being true pros and for making this so much fun. Today's last note is one of my favorite songs about race in America, The Charade by D'Angelo and the Vanguard. One Year Later is a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.